golden glow on the brush facing that direction, but that warm morning light only sharpened the details of the winter weed spikes. Unlike the light cast by a rising sun, however, the orange mist and light forming in the tree did not move at all over the half-hour time period. Moreover, Smith had a third camera, a Tasco, mounted to a separate post right next to the first one, and the Tasco took a photo at 8:04 a.m. that showed a still discernible mist area exactly the same size and shape and in the same position as captured by the Primo's camera. This very effectively rules out the possibility of sun glare as a cause. In both cases, the mist created a fuzzed-out appearance in the branches in the area of the tree where it appeared. The Primo's camera was aimed slightly higher than was the Tasco, so that it showed the entire oval mist area. At the mist top edge was a much denser orange oval that brightened and enlarged as the minutes passed, gradually forming a bright yellow, roughly circular center with deep orange wings to either side of it and a clearly discernible large circle of pale orange mist directly over the carcass, and perhaps 6 feet in diameter. The glowing yellow and orange area slowly begins to shrink and fade, but the mist is still evident in the tree at 8:04 a.m., with blue sky all around it. There is another artifact, however, that shows up consistently for the same duration of time. It's a smallish orange and yellow discoid object in the lower left area of dried grasses that waxes and wanes along the same time frame as the circular mist. It also has a yellow center and orange wings. It does resemble a light reflection, but like the larger light in the tree, it stays in precisely the same spot for the entire half hour. Therefore, it could possibly be a lens reflection of the other object, but not of the sun, which was rising continuously throughout. What caught my attention about this photo series was the large object's similarity to the descriptions of what witnesses at Skinwalker Ranch thought was an interdimensional portal. As discussed earlier, the Utah Ranch's family called them orange structures, and they often saw the light objects form over a low line of cottonwood trees, disgorging black objects and humanoids. Kelleher and Knapp wrote regarding such a sighting, "This incident convinced Tom that his ranch was the site of some kind of dimensional doorway through which a flying object entered, and maybe even exited, this reality." Smith could hardly be blamed for thinking the same thing about his field, although he was unfamiliar with Kelleher and Knapp's book at the time. It was just after 1 p.m. on the same day the orange and yellow lights appeared that Smith observed the very fresh drop-in prints in the adjacent field, so they could have been made at any time during that five-hour period. The landing spot, as Smith likes to call it, was only 110 feet away from the orange light and the carcass remains. Whatever landed didn't seem to want the deer remains. It headed towards some woods to the north, not eastward toward the carcass. The carcass was still there, intact, the next time Smith was able to visit the field, which was on January 22nd. But the next time he was able to check it, on February 12th, the carcass had been completely devoured. The mystery had become maddening to both Smith and me. And then one possibly revealing set of circumstances occurred in February 2014. There were a few deer rib bones lodged in the snow in the same tree line area, and the night of February 20th, Smith's cameras began recording the predations of a pair of coyotes at about 9 p.m. They would take turns keeping watch and tearing tough sinew off the carcass. The coyote doing most of the chewing, however, was extremely nervous. Every so often, strange beams and diagonal shafts of light would appear on the photos, after which the coyote would seem startled and look around before resuming its tough meal. This seemed to come to a head at 2:57 a.m., when the coyote seemed extremely upset at a light intrusion and left the area. There were no more pictures until sunrise, when a few crows showed up. That might have been the end of it, but Smith learned a few days later that a farmer who lives within a mile of his property was alerted at 3 a.m. that morning of February 21st that something was amiss when his animals began raising a ruckus. He looked outside just in time to see a coyote running for its life across his property. In pursuit was a dark, shaggy-furred, mostly upright creature that sometimes hunched over to touch its front limbs to the ground. The man said it stood about 5 feet tall in that hunched position, and it was giving the coyote a great run for its money. The pair soon vanished into the night. It seems very coincidental that Smith's camera would record a coyote leaving a meal in apparent fright, and that then someone in the immediate area would see a coyote being chased by a semi-upright, large, shaggy creature only 3 minutes later. I do believe that coyote in the photo was the same one the farmer saw being chased by the upright canine. The Black Mist and the UFO. After a soggy spring, Smith began to notice more prints in the soft ground of the field in late May and around the beginning of June. He discovered several different kinds, some five-toed bipedal canine prints, and others that included a long, separated heel, probably an imprint of the hock touching down into the soft spring soil, and measured about 7 inches long in total. We were both surprised when a dark-colored disc showed up in the sky in two trail cam shots on May 30, 2014, hovering over the trees alongside an adjacent field. It looked quite solid in the first shot at 11:26 a.m., and then seemed to be blurring out in the second shot, taken at 1:05 p.m. In the second shot, it appears smaller or farther away and has changed its angle relative to the ground. There were no other shots of it before, in between, or after, and no other visible cause for the Moultrie camera to have been triggered. We ruled out insects or dirt on the lens for many reasons, as well as atmospheric conditions, since it was a cloudless, blue-sky day. There had been some remains of a small animal carcass or two lying in the field, but by the day this disc showed up, all that was left of them was fur. A trail of 4-inch by 5-inch fist-shaped prints were found in the adjacent field throughout the month. On May 31st, Smith laid by the tree line a smallish road-killed deer he'd brought from Illinois in his truck, and he positioned the Moultrie trail cam to the other side of the portal tree from where he usually placed it. It was set to take photos every 30 seconds in daylight, then switch to motion or heat detection at night. The next day, June 1st at 5:19 p.m., something we hadn't seen before popped up. First, there was a somewhat darkened but fairly clear shot of the area. Then, 30 seconds later, the scene had changed completely. Most of the right half of the trail cam photo was suddenly obscured by an ink-black mist that ranged from nearly transparent at the edges to completely solid in the entire lower right quadrant of the photo. Bright sky was visible through openings in the treetops, and green stalks of grass on the left side of the photo were still well lit by sunlight. As the minutes went on, the mist moved downward slightly in the picture frame, remaining translucent at the edges and solid below. The camera took 55 photos, starting at 5:19 p.m. and ending at 5:46 p.m. The very last shot showed a somewhat darkened but otherwise clear photo, almost identical to the first. The deer carcass was still there in the same position. Smith returned to the scene to retrieve the SD card from his camera at 11:43 a.m. the next day, June 1st. Sometime between 5:46 p.m. the day before and the time of Smith's arrival, something had picked up the deer carcass and jammed its head and upper torso through the base of two small trees, growing about 8 feet away. The entire quarter of the animal's right front leg was separated almost surgically in a neat circle around the shoulder, and the whole leg was removed from the scene. Who would have wanted it, we wondered. This deer was far too ripe for human consumption, and at that time of year there was enough fresh game in the Wisconsin woods so that even wild predators shouldn't have desired something so rotten. As usual, we will never know, because whatever did that to the deer did not produce enough heat or motion to trigger the camera. There were no tracks, no plants disturbed. That's just wrong on so many levels. The next night, the deer's head and other forelimb were also shoved through the tight spot in the trees. More of the carcass had been eaten. The following night, the deer's torso was completely pushed back out of the two trees. The third night, what was left of the deer's maggot-ridden remains vanished. One other note on that missing right leg haunch. The cut looked too perfect and circular for any animal to have made it. In January 2015, retired newspaper writer Steve Stanek from Hillsboro, Wisconsin, sent me three color photographs containing documentation of similar mutilations. Stanek has been researching cougar habitation in southwest central Wisconsin for years. Could cougars be to blame for all of them? The three photos were from a farmer near Bloom City and show an identical removal of the right leg quarter of one of his cows. It was also surgically precise and round. However, the cow also had suffered classic cattle mutilation marks, a large oval cut away from its jaw and another oval that removed an eye. Southern Wisconsin has no known cougar population, but the leg quarters matched so perfectly it was hard to believe both animals weren't mutilated by the same thing. I found online photos of identical or similar leg quarter removals from many other places as well. Interestingly, two of the three photos from the Bloom City farmer also showed a gray mist hovering over the animal. The third photo, taken in the same series from a different angle, was perfectly bright and clear. Identical mutilations and photos of mists seem curious indeed. Things at Smith's just grew weirder. Various odd light shapes came and went on the trail camera pictures taken through these warm nights, including one around 11:30 p.m. the evening of June 10th that again appeared to be a round shape that emitted light. There were lights that looked like UFOs, orbs, spoked wheels, and so many others that it would take another book to describe them all. My husband and I also spent a good part of the evening of June 11th sitting quietly with Smith in his truck, parked strategically at the side of the field, but nothing cared to show itself to us in person. Tantalizing shots of various portions of some kind of large, black, furry animal have also popped up on the cam photos. Based on comparisons to known landscape features, they seemed at least human-sized and were out in the open where they couldn't be light and shadow. But they were either too far away or too close to give any clear indication of what they might have been. The natural-born killers. I feel we still need to ask whether the predator that so neatly sheared off the legs of the rotting field deer and the Bloom City cow may have been some natural animal. Known carnivores will leave some sort of clue as to their species, and there are a few of those species to consider. Coyotes would be the first culprits I'd think of. Smith's field is always full of their tracks, and they have posed nicely for numerous trail cam photos. Smith and I were even lucky enough to catch a daytime sighting of two of them hustling away as we pulled up in his truck one morning. But coyotes are not known for neatness. They prefer to enter a carcass from the backside and tend to leave bits and pieces strewn about. Removing just a leg quarter and then spiriting it from the site doesn't sound like their modus operandi. It's possible, but I also think they would have left tattered chew marks where the leg was separated, rather than the very clean edges evident in the photos. I imagine that a bear could have easily taken away the leg, but bears are also more likely to enter the abdomen first and remove the rumen, or digestive contents, and will leave big claw cuts and tooth puncture marks in the hide. Bears aren't dainty and often leave a mess of deer hair lying about. Bears do eat rotting meat if they're hungry, but we should have found some of their distinctive prints nearby, and we didn't. Also, there is no established bear population in southeastern Wisconsin. A roving Bruin may travel through the area on occasion, but it would be a rare sight. Mountain lions could probably do a decent job of shearing the hide neatly, slicing it with their incisors. They may also drag away their food to cache it for later feeding. That could explain the carcass being pulled those few feet and partly jammed between the two small tree trunks. Cougars will usually cover up a feeding site with whatever debris is handy, though, and this carcass was left on the ground without any cover. In addition, mountain lions prefer fresh kills. And as in the case of the bears, there were none of their distinctive round paw prints to be seen, and no known breeding population in the area. They do pass through southern Wisconsin, however. A few years ago, officials tracked one through Walworth County. A DNA analysis of the hair and scat it left behind showed that it was the same cat that ended up in Chicago not long after, where it was shot as a risk to area residents. Even closer to home, about 2 years ago, my husband was stalked by a mountain lion in our own backyard, bordering the southern edge of the area's Kettle and Moraine formations. I'll digress briefly to tell this story, because it shows natural predators can and do show up in unexpected places, a fact investigators should never forget. It was a fall evening just after sundown, almost but not quite dark. I was in my office with headphones on, guesting on a radio program, when the Hubs decided to run out to the shed at the back of the yard to fetch something. Having been raised as a Wisconsin farm boy used to running around outside at night, he didn't bother to bring a flashlight. He just stepped out the door into the deepening twilight. He was about 12 feet from the shed when something very close let out a heart-stopping yowl. He stopped, startled, and heard an immediate thud only about 6 feet in front of him. It took him a second to realize what was growling at him, and luckily he had the sense not to turn and run as the big cat began to stealthily advance. He held up his arms and waved them and yelled as he walked backward toward the house, exactly the things to do in such a situation, and it kept a prowling pace with him until he reached our deck. It then slunk off into the Kettle woods. When I finished with my radio program, I pulled off my headphones and walked into the living room where he was sitting, still white as a sheet from the close call. If the animal had gotten him, I never would have heard a thing. The next morning, he spotted it again as he left for work. It was slinking out of a nearby cornfield. Seeing it in broad daylight left no doubt in his mind that it was a mountain lion. It stood and stared at him almost as if it recognized him as the one who got away. Two of our neighbors on opposite ends of the street also saw the cougar on separate occasions, and I found its tracks under my husband's boat, which was parked next to the shed. I've since seen numerous cougar prints on the trails around the northern edges of the Kettle Moraine State Forest Southern Unit. They are definitely in southern Wisconsin. And there are probably even more around Bloom City and Richland County, where the mutilated cow was found. Still, there was no real evidence of a mountain lion at either of the mutilation locations, and the disarticulated, neatly cut leg quarters just seem very odd. There's one other large predator candidate. Gray or timber wolves also migrate through southern Wisconsin, most of them moving from the Black Hills through Minnesota toward the Great Lakes. Several people have told me they've seen them in southern Wisconsin. Smith often finds large canine prints in his field laid out in the characteristic straight-line path of a wolf. And wolves can use their carnassial teeth in a scissor-like way to shear through hide and meat, while their jaws are strong enough to crunch a deer's leg off. They can and will eat rotten meat when necessary. But like other large carnivores, they will usually go for the richer internal organs first. Smith, to his credit, wanted to find out if there was a chance that any of these animals were prowling his hayfield. He had also found a strange, very large pile of dung that was puzzling him, and so he sent a photo to the state's Department of Natural Resources, DNR. Two different agents visited his field in late 2014 and early 2015, and Smith showed them his photos of prints and trackways and the carcass depredations. One officer emailed Smith and said that he couldn't positively ID the scat to species, but suggested it might be from a horse or donkey, even though, as he noted, horse droppings are usually better digested and clumped. Smith does have a neighbor about a mile away who owns a donkey. In another email, he wrote Smith that the large canine and fist-shaped tracks were coyote or dog, but they were larger than coyote or dog prints. And there was no mention made of the fact that a number of these prints were deep and bipedal. In summary, I'd say that there's some possibility that the missing deer haunches may have been taken by a cougar. In Smith's case, however, it seems unlikely that a wayward mountain lion, bear, or wolf would have bothered with the rotting deer in late spring when there was plenty of other food available, and then neatly scissored off the haunch and trotted away with it, leaving the more desirable parts untouched. In the Bloom City cow case, I don't even know what to say about the missing facial parts. Opportunistic smaller animals would be my only guess there. Even if this one carcass depredation in Smith's field can be explained, however, that doesn't help us understand all of the unidentifiable lights, events, and oddities seen there. And there's more. For starters, the farmer who saw the upright, furry creature chasing a coyote across his property wasn't the only one to recently see an upright canine in those parts. Two very credible eyewitnesses reported seeing an upright, dark-furred canine cross Hospital Road west of Lyons, Wisconsin, around Thanksgiving in 2015. This sighting was made by a middle-aged couple driving at night who saw it clearly in their headlights and said it looked exactly as people usually describe the upright canine creatures. They wish to remain anonymous, so I'll leave it at that, except to add that while the encounter wasn't in Smith's field, it was within an easy day's roam. This part of southeast Wisconsin is still where the weird things are. On the morning of April 29, 2015, the trail cam caught three shots. It was again set to take three shots per second of what looked like a large, earless, black-furred head, a back and part of an arm moving on the side of the field where the bait was always placed. The rest of it was hidden by a slight rise in the landscape. It had to have traveled at least 20 feet during that second. It may have been a crow or some large bird, but after an examination of the zoomed photos left us unsure, we decided to try a reenactment. When I trudged out there and posed in the same spot, wearing a hooded jacket for a staged shot taken from the same distance and angle, we were able to determine the black-furred thing was definitely larger than my 5'1" frame. That's not so big for a human, but fairly good-sized for any other animals likely to be crouched in a field near a shredded deer carcass. Unfortunately, it was too far away to identify. It could have been many things, just nothing we could prove. The Curious Sphere. By August 2015, Smith and I had recorded many unexplainable things in our field notes, including large canine bipedal tracks and at least five instances when we noticed sudden super pungent odors at the site that were best described as the sharpest old dog urine smell possible. We had witnessed and photographed unidentifiable piles of dung, lights zipping around the field at night, odd flying objects, close-up shots of something black and furry very near the camera lens, columns of dense mist, and continuing reports of upright creatures in the very near vicinity. During all of this, the true movers and shakers of these manifestations managed to stay hidden by one trick or another. Smith and I did not know that at least one of those movers would decide on a personal meeting. It happened the evening of August 12, 2015. I suggested we try a night watch to see if something might show itself circling the area. He agreed. I invited my trail-hiking colleague Sanjay Singhal, host of Beyond the Forest Radio, and that evening found the three of us bumping along the dirt path to Smith's field, Singhal at the wheel and Smith riding shotgun. I had taken my preferred spot in the back seat, where I can always see what's behind us and to either side. It was a warm, mostly clear night, with the Perseid meteor shower affording an occasional spectacle of shooting stars streaking through the sky. There were also many airplanes following a much-used flight path above the tree line. We parked the car across the field from those trees so that we had a clear line of sight. I had my Sony camera ready with night settings, and we sat chatting and watching the planes and meteors. Smith and I had staked out his field at night before with few results, so we weren't expecting much. The tricksters that visited his field seemed to operate best in seclusion. After about an hour of watching, I noticed one plane seemed to have stopped in its path and was moving backward, then forward, then backward. This was no simple oscillation or pendulum effect often observed by sky watchers, and it certainly wasn't a meteor. Although the craft's bright white light looked the same as the planes that had been passing through all evening, I knew that this object was something different. "That's no plane over there," I pointed out. Smith and Singhal agreed, and we all watched it for a couple of minutes, remarking now and then on its motions. It moved back and forth a few more times, and then, to our dumbfounded consternation, it began to head straight toward us. It now had our full attention, whatever it was. It was soundless. Singhal's window was rolled down, and we couldn't hear anything at all from it. Smith's field is surrounded by other fields, so it wasn't some sort of errant farm equipment suddenly popping out of a neighbor's barn. We ruled out a possible helicopter as well. I realized, as it drew closer and closer over the space of a minute or two, that it seemed to be gradually adjusting its size so as to retain the same appearance as an airplane light as it neared us. Interestingly, it appeared as one round white light to Smith and me as it approached, while Singhal perceived it as two separate round white lights, one above the other. Smith and I also both saw a violet-blue, smaller light to its left that remained in the same relative position to the larger light, but Singhal did not notice the blue one. I'm not sure what the reason for that discrepancy might be, other than that Singhal is nearsighted and Smith and I are both farsighted. Singhal was the only one wearing glasses at the time. And yet we all agreed this light form seemed to be purposely advancing upon us. I hit the power button on my camera and prepared to shoot as the light finally slowed to a stop, perhaps 30 feet from the car and 30 feet above the ground. At this time, I judged it to be the size of a basketball. Singhal thought it was somewhat smaller. Smith agreed the size was somewhere within those parameters. I was just bringing my camera up to start shooting when Singhal grabbed a large flashlight Smith had brought along and aimed it out the window and directly at the round form. There was a brief moment, almost as if the light form was surprised. That was the impression all of us had, and then it suddenly disintegrated right in front of us. Singhal saw the two lights he was observing wink out consecutively. We all yelled simultaneous exclamations. This light ball had appeared solid, not just some nebulous wisp. To see it just instantly vanish after the flashlight was directed upon it was astonishing. Singal decided to get out of the car and have a look around. Smith and I both preferred to stay put. After a minute or so, Singal got back into the car and told us he wasn't feeling well and that he wished to leave. So we did. We were all in shock at what we'd just witnessed. There was no rational explanation we could think of, although you can bet we tried. No, I didn't get my picture of it. And yes, I'm still kicking myself for not having set my camera on video mode and filming a little sooner. Singal and I have wondered whether his quick action prevented some type of interaction between the light form and the three of us. Sudden appearances of such things are often preludes to missing time, abduction scenarios, and other strange events in both modern fairy and UFO lore and ancient tales. It did originate, or at least was first spotted, at the field's usual zone of action, where the portal-like orange lights and columns of mist have shown up. Nothing like it has shown up since that we know of. Considering that over 2 years have passed since Smith began his experiments, I asked him why he continued to devote so much time and effort to this ongoing field test. "I see it as a research project," said Smith. "If I can give some enlightenment to this world of cryptozoology that has been vilified and disrespected, that would be a positive thing." Chapter 26. Physics and the Other World. It's been an eye-opening experience for me to learn just how many witnesses of creatures unknown to science have reported weird anomalies, either in the creatures themselves or in the vicinity of the sightings. Para-reality constructs like portals, fairy paths, UFOs, and even the telepathic, sometimes invisible alien animals of Janet and Colin Board begin to look less fantastic and more like viable pieces of the great puzzle that is our world. The very definition of the word reality warps and shimmers as we learn that recent scientific discoveries support the possibility of parallel universes. I believe I was correct in the beginning of this book, however, when I predicted we wouldn't be able to draw any hard and fast conclusions about these phenomena and how they're related. I also don't assume that the specific reports that happen to come my way represent strange creature sightings throughout time and history. There could be many more or many less, and beaucoup variations. We just don't know. And yet, the lack of proof positive doesn't mean that these connections never happen or that they should be ignored or minimized. Observations by credible, sincere people must be included in reports. Also, we need more studies. But let's take a look at the patterns, or occasional lack thereof, that emerged here, such as transforming or apparently transformative werewolves showed no directly associated anomalies such as lights or UFOs, although some traditional Native American versions of shapeshifters are believed to also appear as fiery orange and sometimes white orbs. The intruders called bedroom invaders, while obviously something other than flesh and blood animals, did not seem associated with any other outside anomalies. Roadside creatures acting aggressively toward cars were not usually associated with other observed anomalies in their appearances and actions, except most witnesses noticed they had elongated paws or paw hands, and in the case of the road-crossing dogman that glowed blue, itself. I'm not counting bipedal posture, since natural canines can walk upright if motivated to do so. Witnesses observed poltergeist activities in their homes in 3 out of the 33 case summaries. Specific telepathic messages directed at witnesses were noted in 2 of the 33 case summaries. 4 instances out of 33 case summaries showed a close time association with major solar flares. 3 of these were associated with upright canine sightings, 1 with a UFO. 8 out of 33 case summaries were associated with UFOs in a range from strongly to only somewhat connected. 6 out of 33 case summaries involved colored lights of various sizes and forms. 5 out of 33 case summaries and several more out of additional uncharted events involved rolling mists, fear zones, time discrepancies, and other Oz factor type anomalies. Again, this is an admittedly short list drawn from a limited number of events and is not intended as a scholarly statistical model. As I noted in the introduction, I meant for this book to be more of a study of anomalous encounters than a stab at finding a theory of everything for strange phenomena. And yet, the fact that out of 33 strange events I charted, nearly one-fourth were found to have some known or reported association with a UFO seems significant. I feel it's also likely there may be a vast unknown reservoir of sightings of strange creatures and other phenomena that were never reported by witnesses, but that, if known, could contribute greatly to our study of the associations between them. The previously mentioned John Keel, best known for his in-depth research of the flying beast called Mothman of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, spotted the relation between monsters and unidentified lights early on. Keel said in an interview for the September 2007 issue of Fate magazine that in addition to Mothman, there were also numerous sightings of UFOs around Point Pleasant in the mid-1960s. He described seeing many unknown light structures as he inspected cases of animal mutilations and said that he thought the lights were mischievous masses of energy playing simple-minded games with a simple-minded human. This is very similar to the way Single, Smith, and I felt about the road light form we encountered in Smith's Wisconsin hayfield, and is also suggestive of that possible quantum interaction between unknown intelligences and the human mind. Looking to theories of advanced physics for answers feels encouraging, as if we are finally getting somewhere. And yet, these theories aren't necessarily helpful in a practical way. It isn't as if our scientists now have ready access to wormholes, portals, and other dimensions containing inhabitants that may be tagged and examined at whim. And as new mathematical formulas continue to predict these worlds, more and more theoretical scenarios present themselves. One of the latest models is an unending realm known as the multiverse. Alan Lightman affirms this truth flat out in The Accidental Universe. The possibility of the multiverse is actually predicted by modern theories of physics. He notes two of many such possibilities. There's the eternal inflation theory, in which the original rapidly expanding universe spawns a multitude of new universes in a never-ending process. And the better-known string theory, of which Lightman says, in the last few years, physicists have discovered that string theory does not predict a unique universe, but a vast number of possible universes with different properties. What might that mean to us, personally? In a chapter about spiritual implications of these new scientific theories, Lightman, a self-described atheist, also quotes a view from Owen Gingrich, Harvard University professor emeritus of astronomy and the history of science, who says, "I believe that our physical universe is somehow wrapped within a broader and deeper spiritual universe in which miracles can occur." If there are miracles, couldn't those miracles include impossible creatures and other forms of intelligence? Or perhaps the creatures are not really here on our earthly plane at all, but merely passing through a parallel world in time or space at a point where their world momentarily intersects with our own. This would be an example of a theoretical multiple-world construct known as the many interacting worlds theory. Smithsonian.com recently quoted New Scientist writer Michael Slezak on the explanation for such an idea, given by quantum physicist Howard Wiseman. One way to think about it is that they coexist in the same space as our universe, like ghost universes, Wiseman says. These other worlds are mostly invisible because they only interact with ours under very strict conditions, and only in very minute ways, he says, via a force acting between similar particles in different universes. But this interaction could be enough to explain quantum mechanics. Wiseman also said that these other worlds are not only as real as ours, but have been here as long or longer. Most pertinent to the idea of human or unknown creature contact is the fact that these worlds do interact, even if only in minute ways. Other proposals abound, too, such as that there are other entire dimensions nested and curled around one another, and that we are some part of the conglomeration. To think that all of these elegant and mind-blowing models come from valid mathematical computations makes my non-mathematical mind spin like a vortex in a black hole. How can we possibly know which model is right? Well, I'm not sure that we can. It's a fool's errand, I think, to try to choose exactly which theoretical realm is opening portals to spit out packs of upright canines and fleets of UFOs. None of the proposed alternate worlds are as yet a proven source of unknown phenomena. For all we know, there may be more than one such place. And it's also possible our visitors are an unseen but natural part of our own world. All we can do is continue to keep a sharp eye on the strange phenomena, even as they keep their sharp, glowing eyes upon us. This may be humanity's ultimate stare down. This concludes Monsters Among Us by Linda S. Godfrey, narrated by Emily Durante. Copyright 2016 by Linda S. Godfrey. This unabridged audiobook is recorded by arrangement with Tarcher Perigee, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC, and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.